Welcome to A Path Home. This is the podcast where we demystify the tasks related to after-death care through hearing stories from people who have cared for their own deceased loved ones at home. I'm your host, Sarah Cruz. I'm the director of Heartland Prairie Cemetery, a home funeral guide, death educator, and a member of the National Home Funeral Alliance. On this episode, I have a really nice conversation with Michael Judd. Recently, Michael shared a beautifully made video with the NHFA about his family's profound experience of creating a home burial space on their property in rural Maryland. You'll find the link to the video and Michael's website in the show notes. Michael's father died in 2015 and was the first family member to be buried in the family cemetery. Hi, Michael. I want to thank you so much for being with me today on A Path Home. You sent a beautiful video that was made about the experience that you and your family had in laying your father to rest on your property.
Yeah, foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
And it was just an extraordinary experience because not only did you care for him at home while he was dying and then care for his body after he died, but he was buried right there on your property and he was involved in the entire thing. So maybe we could start with you telling me a little bit about your father.
My father was born John Christopher Judd in October of 1941 in Cleveland, Ohio, to a single mother who couldn't really afford to feed him and his brother at the time. And so he actually was put in an orphanage. Not really allowed to be adopted, but put in an orphanage just so he'd be fed for a number of years. And then when my grandmother, his mother, was able, she brought him back home. So he didn't have the easiest of beginnings to life. The reason I'm telling you this part is because he was such a generous, kind, giving, just amicable soul that really came through a lot of difficulties early in life and lived a beautiful life, a full life, and generated all that he needed, family and work and wealth, based on who he was. Obviously not where he came from or what he grew up with.
Wow.
So, yeah. And he was a swimmer and got a scholarship to go into the Navy. And that's how he got to, get an education, worked in submarines. And during that time in the submarines, one of the things they had to do was learn how the submarines were built. So they'd be in these large warehouses where they were putting submarines together, and part of that process included asbestos. Did I say that right?
Asbestos, yeah. Asbestos.
Asbestos, yes, asbestos. And, at the time, obviously, common people didn't know that it was harmful, but he got heavily exposed. And that came back around later, 71 years of age. He developed mesothelioma, and it kind of came on all of a sudden, within a weekend. He wasn't feeling well and went to the hospital and got that diagnosis very, very quickly. Two weeks prior, we'd had our first child. Wyatt Judd was born at home. We had a home birth. And so life was great. Life was new. And then 2 weeks later, my father got this diagnosis, and it was a powerful time for all of us, certainly me, sitting sort of in the middle of having, becoming a father and losing a father. Mm-hmm. And I, at the moment that my father got his diagnosis, just kind of jumped to his death. And was very stricken by it, and he was very calm. He said, it's okay. We've got time. Let's be at ease. And that was his his way of dealing with the entire process of his dying and his death, which you know went over a course of 18 months. Mm-hmm. He really hung in there because he was in many ways living fully during that last year and a half, and he even said that it was one of the best years of his life. And which is remarkable because he really struggled physically, went through a lot, pain wise and just, transition wise. But he really just shone through the whole thing. His body kind of disintegrated, his eyes would just shine. The spirit would be, we'd come forward more as the body receded. And it was amazing, it was powerful. It made some people uncomfortable, to see, spirit staring straight at you.
Right.
He'd want to, he'd hold your hand and he'd keep holding it and he'd keep looking at you, which was wonderful. But, a lot of people uncomfortable. But that's just where he was. He was just really very alive, very much enjoying and appreciating life. And during that time, we gathered a lot as a family. He kind of set up camp in the living room on the couch, and we all just gathered there all the time. We'd make fires in the wintertime, and we'd be having picnics, anything we could come up with just to to be there. And we really enjoyed it as a family. We spent more time together then than ever.
So, Michael, was this a generational household? You were all living together in the same house?
Well, no, my parents have about 25 acres, beautiful, sort of mostly woodland with a creek running through it, property here in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And we have about during the same time that my father was passing and my son was being born, we were actually building a circular straw bale house here on the property as well. So we were nearby. My brother, and my sister, were within an hour reach and their families. So, we kind of rotated in and out. It was kind of the beehive, if you would, of our family and family and friends. It's always been an open door kind of house anyway. We always welcome everybody. And so, it was actually quite a joyous time. It was not easy, but there was a lot of joy as well. And so during this time, at some point hospice came in just for sort of early consultation, what is hospice? What do we do? And they left us with a sheet. And at the bottom of the back of that sheet, there was one mention for home burial, crossings, crossings.net. So of course I kind of latched onto that. I design ecological edible landscapes. I work with permaculture design, natural building. So I live within ecological systems. So I'm very, very aware of how things, die and give life, in the circle of life. But I'd never experienced it intimately with with a human. I mean, alone a loved one. But so right away it's like, oh, well, that makes sense. Yes, Let's keep everything, full circle here.
Right. So you totally resonated with that from the moment you read it. But was that the first time that it had dawned on you that this was possible, keeping, caring for your own dead?
I think so, which is kind of surprising with all the places I've lived all around the world and a lot of alternative communities. Permaculture communities and whatnot. And so it was kind of, the first sort of realistic, whoa, can we do this? Is this possible? Mm-hmm. Didn't really have a strong, example to go by. So it was new. It was totally new to me, but it resonated right away. And I looked up the information about crossings and then sort of gathered our immediate family, my father included. And I said, I'd like to explore this. Would you all be willing and open to creating a home cemetery if we can? So, you know, no one had thought about it either. And my father had actually been planning to have his body donated to science.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So that was, you know, he was an engineer and, you know, that was kind of what he, you know, something that was meaningful to him. But I think even just in that moment, he realized how important this could be for us. And I think, you know, he let go of that and said that he would be in support of that. He would let go of his intention to be donated to science and allow himself to be buried here if we could do it.
It speaks to his generosity towards his family, hearing that this was something that might be important to the rest of you and going, okay, let's do this.
Yes, he is he's really the main reason that the experience that we've had and that we've all grown so much from was able to take place. He really gave us so much in his passing. One of his greatest gifts was in his death, dying in death. And it certainly has shaped and shifted my life dramatically to where this is very core to what I want to do with my life, helping and sharing others with what I've learned and what's possible. So then I started doing the research and reading about what you could do in Maryland. And first step was to call the health department. So I called county health department and said, you know, I'd like to see about getting a home cemetery. Can someone come out? Or, you know, what's the process? And they said, we don't know. Let us check. And I was like, fine, okay, you know, waited a couple of days. I called back and, oh yeah, you can do that. Didn't know that. And then so they came out and they said, where are you thinking? And we had about a quarter of an acre planned because we got a lot of property. So it doesn't have to be that big, but we said, here it is. And came out and measured to the well, 100 feet, you're fine. We have a creek. They measured 100 feet to the floodplain. You're fine. And they said, you're good to go. And I was like, that's it. And they're like, yeah, get it surveyed and submit your survey, you know, with a letter to the county zoning and you're done. The surveyor, I think, maybe cost upwards of $2,000. And then that was it. That's the only expense we've had. We've buried two of our family there already. You know, that's $1,000 a piece. And it's going to go down every time one of us is buried there to where at some point it might just be $50 a pop. So I think even just economically, this is a phenomenal opportunity and reason. I mean, that's low on my list for reasons to do it. But, right, you know, for some folks who aren't hearing the rest of the story, when I'm talking about this, you know, they might be like, wow, that definitely makes economic sense, which it does. Don't think that you need a big piece of land to do this. I would do the investigations in your county to find out, you know, what the distance regulations are. So for neighbors and stuff, it was just setbacks like you would for construction. And you know, the cemetery would have needed to be 10 feet from the border of our property. It was kind of at the entrance to the woods in an area where there really wasn't any mature trees. And so I was able to kind of just clear it out, not the entire area, probably cleared less than an eighth of an acre. And it's on a slight hill. So we created a couple of stone terraces and a nice stone walkway in. A friend of ours makes beautiful clay bells. So we put up these clay bells that you can ring as you come in and out. And just a sweet little space. It's very, very kind of close to our family home and right by the driveway. And so it's not like in your face, but it's right there. And it's so nice that it's still so part of our daily life and flow and a beautiful space to share and show people who want to when they come over. And it's so natural and easy. And I don't know, intimate in a sweet, sweet, natural way.
Nice.
And you'd be surprised that the law is in your favor to do this. It's just not really known about. Practice. So since then, I've done a lot of talks about, you know, home burial and home funeral care, and especially in our area and how you do it. And a few home cemeteries have been created, you know, from my sharings already. And really, a lot of people come to the talks and they're just amazed. They're like, can we do this? And I'm like, yes, you can. And it's actually pretty straightforward. So one of my messages is always find out. Obviously, every county, every state is going to be a little bit different, but you might be surprised that, yes, you can do this very easily. And I guess the Home Funeral Alliance might have some information about state by state. Is that right?
We have a little bit of information state by state, and not so much about home burials. It's more about the after-death care and the funeral care.
Right. So there might be a lot of freedom for creating your own home cemetery still across the country.
Right. It's so much about educating people in our communities, because this is a practice that has fallen away, that the more we get out there and let people know what's possible.
Yeah. Just sharing, letting people know that it's actually quite simple and very beautiful. And offers, personally, I would say a lot more opportunity in the experience of transitioning, for a loved one and the family. And I can share a little bit of our story as well.
I was just going to ask you, let's back up to when your father passed and the preparations that you all had made.
Yeah. So we had hospice care, which in our case wasn't too much, because it was a strong family. We were there a lot to care for my father. But there, coming up toward the end of his life, they had a hospice, roll bed brought into our living room. And my father finally got off the couch and got on the bed. We sat with him. People came and visited a lot. We would lay with him, in his final days, during the night as well, taking turns. And he died. He passed early in the morning. My sister was there. And we'd also done a little bit of preparing with a friend who is a death doula, someone who helps families and those transitioning, just kind of talk about and understand, what the options are. And so we had a friend named Rose Ma, who was also understanding what was going on. So that morning, we called Rosemond. She came over with her son to help as well, which was great, because even though we had talked and planned and read everything about what to do, we were a little stunned. We were a little frozen. So it was helpful just to have someone gently say, "Okay, now do this. Go in here. How about someone make some food?" Just kind of, helping you along.
Mm-hmm. Getting you to make those next steps.
Yes. So it's not complicated, but it was just helpful to have someone, wasn't kind of just bereaved. And because even though we knew it was coming, it was still an impact for it to finally happen. And it was nice to have the hospice bed. We wheeled it into our other sort of family room, and Rosemond guided us in lighting candles, and we got some rose water, and we had some pictures of Dad and his mother and his brother, and just created this peaceful environment. And then we slowly started to bathe him with sort of rose water and towels. And not everybody wanted to do that. At this point, there was probably 10, 12 people at our house, family. And some of us were called to do that, really wanted to do that. I certainly did. I didn't want to leave him. I didn't want to leave his side. My mother didn't want to do that. She was in the kitchen, and a few others, making food. My brother didn't want to do that. He went out and started helping dig the grave. And it was so helpful that we all had something to do and we had choices. It was part of our process. It was part of our grieving. And so we washed him and changed him, put on just some of his regular clothes, some of his favorite comfortable corduroy pants and, you know, shirt. And
did Rosemar have you cool the body with ice? Or?
Yeah. So we had dry ice. Someone helped us pick up some dry ice. We were prepared for that. And so, yeah, we had dry ice. We put in some pillowcases. We put under my father's back, on his stomach, under his head. And that might have been it, you know, since he wasn't very active when he died. He started to cool down pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And so that was key. Yes, that was key, that we had him, you know, cooling as soon as possible. And so, gosh, it's still even a little bit hard to talk about. And we washed him, and then, I sat there with him. I didn't want to leave, and people came and went, and, you know, life was moving around. It didn't feel like it didn't feel cut off. It didn't feel like, you know, even though he had died, he wasn't gone. Mm-hmm. He was still there with us in so many ways. And I had read and heard many traditions talk about how they would sit with their loved ones after dying for 3 days as the, you know, as the spirit transitioned. And I was like, okay, I'd be happy to, you know, give that a try. You know, just, I'm not in a hurry anyway to have him gone. And from my experience, it's very true. And I understood this on the third day, where all of a sudden, you know, when I got up and I saw him that morning, he was gone. Whereas before he was not gone, there were some changes in skin color. Some of it was just subtle energy. You know, the energy, it's hard to explain, but you know, the third day he was totally gone. Mm-hmm. And then I felt, you know, comfortable to help bury him. But I would not have felt comfortable burying him or letting him go before that, because there was transition. Certainly for us, there was a lot of transition, but his soul, his something, whatever, was in transition. And we were holding space, loving space for all of us, and certainly for him. And that really showed me that the importance of holding your loved ones as they transition, holding space and love, which unfortunately, you know, in our popular culture doesn't happen very much these days. It's whisked away and the loved one is stuck in a black bag and a cooler and, you know, somebody who doesn't know them, you know, in a funeral home. And it's,
right. It's, and not, then the family is just sort of left alone and adrift and trying to find their way through a process that has been taken from them.
Yeah, they're like empty handed, you know, and just rubbing their hands and just not knowing or not having any process. And I think through all of this, I also learned, I never really understood what ritual was before this either. I just always figured that was something very, very spiritual, very practiced, or some, you know, religious, you know, like you had to have some real special, you know, initiation to be able to do it. And I realized after this, that ritual is just any process, any action in, you know, in that space, certainly around death and dying, washing the body, to digging the grave, to making food. I mean, any little thing to me was ritual, and it helped me process. And I needed all that processing and I needed all the ritual. And without having experience, none of us knew anything about any of this. We'd never done this with any of our loved ones before. So, but it was also natural and it was easy.
Yeah, just following your hearts and doing all of that with intention is what brings the ritual to it, I guess.
It does. It wasn't, you know, ritual wasn't mysterious anymore. It was just whatever you needed or wanted to do, It was just making things, you know, sacred because of, yeah, the space that you were in with it. And that, you know, the night after he died, we said, well, let's invite people over, you know, whoever wants to come see Dad before we bury him, you know, all his extensive friends, even some family from out of town. And it was kind of an unintentional wake, because we didn't really know what a wake was or, you know, have a plan for it. But that's what it ended up being. We had a house full. We had, you know, 60 plus people in our house. And it was a party. It was loved ones getting together. You know, it was everybody loving each other because, you know, because of the challenge of the time. Everyone was being very loving and giving and supportive. And my dad was there, and people could, you know, come in and give their love and respect to him, you know, say goodbye, you know, for their processing to be able to say goodbye was important.
It's so beautiful that so many of these people had, I mean, probably everyone had not had that experience of having his body still present with you there and being able to really step close to him and into that sacred space that you had created, and allowing yourself the time and the space to get in touch with the sort of dimensions of the loss.
You know, and being in an informal environment, you know, versus, you know, a quick show in a casket.
Right, in your own familiar space.
Right. Yeah. We pretty well known for holiday family parties and things. So it was very much like that in our house. And everyone did have their own time and space to go and to be with Dad. And there were children everywhere. You know, there was children throughout this whole process. You know, all his grandchildren were present during this. You know, everything from age 4 to probably age 14 at that point, you know, were part of this entire process. And this was their first experience with death. So this is, for them, this is what happens, which is great. You know,
Isn't that great? That's so beautiful. Yeah, this is how we do it in this family.
This is how we care for each other. And I think that builds a sense of security too, you know, knowing that you're going to be held, you know, in this life by your loved ones. And then, you know, even in your death and your dying, you're going to be held. Mm-hmm. You're going to be cared for. And I think knowing that would certainly makes me feel better.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's a normal for the children. Nothing was hidden from them. You know, they were part of whatever they wanted to do. Dig the grave, you know, wash the body, you know, be with grandfather. Yeah. And then the last day, the third day, we had actually talked to a family friend who was kind of a spiritual head of a unity church. And she'd come out and talk to us, you know, many months earlier about, you know, helping us officiate or something. But she was out of town. So it was just us, and which was fine. But again, we'd never done this, you know, but we were strong. We are a strong family, and that helped. But at the same time, we were just making it up. So we circled around my father. There was probably 12 of us. And we just went around in a circle and just said, hey, you know, how did, you know, he touch your life? And that was beautiful. Everyone really brought out something very special that he'd meant to them. And then we got a 2x12, just a regular board, about 6 feet long, and drilled a couple of 2x2s on the bottom of it. And we put my father on top of that, still on the hospice bed, lifted him up and put him on this board. And then my sister, my mother had some silk fabric left over from making my sister's wedding dress 25 years earlier.
Wow.
Yeah, it's beautiful pink silk. And we wrapped my father and the board together so that he was well attached to it. And Then we just, you know, four of us grabbed those 2x2 handles and, you know, carried him out the door. And the little home cemetery we created, you know, 100 yards away, it's sort of the edge of the woods. And we just kind of silently, you know, walked there. And that was powerful too. Just this silent procession of being together and just honoring this space and time. And yeah, and then lowered him with ropes into the bottom of the grave. And it was, I was about 4 feet deep, you know, not very wide, maybe 3 feet, certainly not uniform. Just a hole dug out of the ground, and laid him down there, and we placed flowers and other things that we'd had on him. And again, just kind of stood in a circle, and my mom read a poem, a beautiful poem. And if anyone had something to say, they did, but we were mostly just being present there. And then we, you know, those who wanted to, we started to fill the grave in. And that was surprisingly hard, you know, to start covering my father. I remember it being very hard to put the soil over his head.
Yeah.
I think there was a, you know, another step of understanding and finality in doing that, which again was good, not easy, but it was still helpful to be going through these stages, these processes of letting go, of recognizing, you know, that this is so.
And having the very physical experience of doing it yourselves rather than, you know, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we can't really quantify how much we've lost as families and communities by outsourcing the care of our dead, you know, from the body washing to the preparing for burial to doing the actual burial activities ourselves, the digging and the covering. It really is such a deeply felt process then. You know?
Yeah. I think you lose a lot when you don't have the opportunity to do it. And which is very much what we learned from going through it. And yeah, there was, you know, nobody else being there. We weren't on anyone's time schedule. And, you know, we weren't worried about doing things wrong. And so it was just very open and free and, you know, allowing. Which I thought just, you know, was very important. And then I didn't want to leave again. I didn't want to leave my father. So we, you know, pulled out some straw bales to sit on, and I made a fire.
Nice.
By his grave, and maybe four or five of us stayed there into the night, you know, drinking whiskey and just being there. Just not wanting to let go, just wanting more process. I just kept needing to be doing something around all of this. I didn't want to walk away. I just had so much to still come out, even so much had already come out, so much emotion, so much bereavement, so much was coming out of me. And I just needed more opportunity. And so, I mean, it was quite satisfying. I think I did as best as maybe I could under the circumstances. But I've still got more to come out, you know, and there's been stages, you know, for a year it was strongly coming out. And I've been reading about other cultures. The Mexican culture really spends time every year coming back to that celebration and bereavement of their loved ones. And mm-hmm. I think that's still a missing part, you know, for me. My father's here. I go and I see and I tend to the home cemetery, and, you know, he feels there all, you know, I feel him, you know, nearby. It was great because he never left, you know, he never physically like left. And that felt, that's helped a lot, that he didn't even have to go anywhere when he died, mm-hmm. That he never left. But I could do with some more. I could do with some more ceremony. I could do with something yearly or, you know. And a lot of cultures do that, and I can see the value of that, just to continue making sure that you're processing anything that you're still holding. You know, in this conversation here, I can feel things coming up. That means I still have them. You know, they're still still in me. They still need airing. They still need, you know, releasing and celebrating. So I, you know, there's a lot more still, even with all we've done. And hopefully I will guide, you know, my life and, you know, bring more of that in.
Yeah. Sounds like you're doing it, Michael. It's really great.
It's very real.
Yeah. It's very real. It doesn't get any realer than that, does it?
Mm-hmm. One thing I was thinking of that I didn't mention, it might be something of interest, is that so when my father died, the hospice nurse came out with a death certificate. Well, first she came out and said, yes, he's dead. And then she went to the hospice doctor, went to wherever he was, and he just signed the death certificate. And she knew we were going to do a home burial. So she just brought that back to us and gave it to us. And it's like, now you're in charge. So the first page was the doctor saying, you know, this is, he died and everything's fine. No foul play. The second page, and what was interesting is it's kind of an application to fill out. And it just always said funeral director, funeral director, funeral director. And I was told, you know, I'd already learned. That's you. You put your name in there. But it was kind of off-putting, you know.
Right.
But it was a great learning lesson. You know, the funeral directors really don't have any power. You know, nobody has power over your loved one's body unless there's been some odd circumstances, you know. And I think we've lost understanding of that. But certainly the funeral home has no say.
Right. They can't claim custody to that body. It belongs to you and the family.
That's right. It doesn't belong to the hospital. It doesn't belong. It belongs to you, you know, or the next person, you know, whoever has really got that charge for that loved one, you know, they've got the rights. And I think that's another important part that people need to understand. So anyway, yeah, we filled that out. And then the third sheet was a transportation document. You know, so that if we needed to or wanted to, we could transport, you know, the body. And again, funeral director, we just put our name in. And indeed, a month later, my grandmother died. My father's mother died. She was waiting for him to die before she did. She was 94, 95. And so she was waiting, and she lived just down the road, too. So we... You know, a month later or 2 months later at most, we were doing the same process again. And she lived in an old folks home, and we had to let them know. We were like, we're going to do this. We're actually going to come and take her away and bury her ourselves. And so we had to pre-talk to them and let them know. They was like, well, we got to make sure you can do that. So again, and then indeed, you know, after we'd washed her, we wrapped her and put her in the back of Subaru. And drove her, you know, up to our family home here and sat with her for 3 days and buried her ourselves. So it was surprising how much we are allowed to do and we can do. And I think, yeah, it's important to know that we have a lot of rights around caring for our loved ones.
So many people don't know that. Even people in positions of authority, like at the zoning department or in the nursing home or at the hospital, those folks also need to be educated as to what our rights are around death.
Absolutely. I think just knowing that you don't have to let go of your loved ones. You know, there might be certain circumstances, of course, but generally speaking, know that you can hold space. You can bring them home, you know, and be with them, even if it's just for a few hours, whatever. You can be at home with your loved ones, you know, take your time. I think that's what people need to understand. And if you're going to do it for an extended period of time, then yes, use some kind of cooling, dry ice, or maybe Sarah, you can have a better recommendation for a way to help cool the body, so that it's not unpleasant to be with.
Right. Well, dry ice works really well. Some people find it, you know, it's a little tricky to work with, as you know. You can also just use ice packs, you know, that you might have in the freezer. I actually know a family that used frozen water bottles You know, you have to replace them more often than dry ice, but it's really possible with very simple techniques.
Yeah.
Even air conditioning. Or if it's the middle of winter, open up the window in the room where the person is. It's really important that you cool down the torso first, because that's where all of our organs are, and that part needs to get cooled down relatively quickly. And certainly the dying process is gonna, you know, some people die with their temperature already elevated. So in that case, getting it down in a hurry, something like dry ice is gonna be a better option there. Thank you for taking the time to share this experience.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to continue the conversation. And it's where I'm putting myself more and more, and understanding that it really is just a conversation, and there's no wrong way to talk about death. I heard someone recently say, was it, no one wants to talk about death until you bring it up. And then, you know, then they want to talk about it. I mean, not everybody, but I thought that was funny because it's kind of true. A lot of people are eager for the conversation, but just, you know, I just need help bringing it up. And the death cafes are great for that.
Right. Clearly, just the fact that that took off like it did speaks to how much people want to talk about it. When I got interested in all of this and in death and dying and started working in this area, I kind of was also under the impression that, oh, people don't really want to talk about death, but found in reality the exact opposite. As soon as I bring up what it is that I do and that I'm interested in and my passions, immediately people are sharing their stories. And it's almost like a relief that someone else has brought it up so that we can talk about it and we can share our stories, because it's so much about, you know, what makes us human.
Yeah. Yeah. And we all have a relationship with death already. And I think a lot of it's just about improving that relationship. You know, it's there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's try and make it healthier, because it strongly influences us, that relationship. Even if it's in denial, and that's affecting us. And I think the more that we come into a good relationship and acceptance with it, the better our life now, the quality of our life today improves. And it's not about like when you get to, you know, the doorway of death. It's now. Yeah, it's now. It's here.
Mm-hmm. It's always here. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Thank you to the National Home Funeral Alliance for sharing understanding and resources. And if anybody wants to share the video, please, it's open for sharing as much as possible.
Thank you. We're happy to spread the word through your experience, through your story.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
A Path Home is a production of the National Home Funeral Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating and advocating for communities and families who choose to care for their own loved ones at death. Check out our website at homefuneralalliance.org. If you like this podcast, be sure to tell a friend and subscribe and review wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to share your home funeral or natural burial experience on the podcast, please email me at podcast@homefuneralalliance.org. We'd love to hear from you. The music at the beginning and end of A Path Home is written and performed by Sarah Cruz. Our beautiful cover art is by Linda Curray. And until next time, remember the words of Ram Dass. We are all walking each other home.
I want to be there to walk you home. I'll tend to your body, you'll tend to my soul. And if it happens,